Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Open Book, your weekly spiritual book club. I'm Laurie Strawn, and with me, as usual, is my good friend Alice Shelton. Hi, Alice.
Hello, Laurie.
Today we're going to come back to Lauren Winter's book, Wearing God, which talks about some of the offbeat ways God is described in the Bible through metaphors like clothing, laughter, flame, food, and other things. These metaphors aren't ones that people generally talk about, and that's exactly why they're a great fodder for our show. We begin with a quotation that talks about God as a sensory experience. Of course, many people in the Bible see God in various ways, but what about the sense of smell? In Isaiah 11, we read, "And by his smelling in awe of the Lord, and not by what his eyes see, will the Messiah judge, and not by what his ears hear will he decide." And as the author of this book says, quote, "The God of the Bible smells in both senses of the term. God emits a fragrance, and more centrally, in biblical texts, God inhales aromas and perceives scent." Well, let's begin with this whole idea of God emitting a smell. What do you suppose God smells like, Alice?
I just had a couple thoughts. One is like, you know how new babies smell? I mean, I think God come, you know, I don't know, but that to me is kind of like what God would smell like, or flowers, or there's a smell that if I would sleep in my mom's bed in our guest room pretty soon after she died, there was a mom smell there. Mm-hmm. So I just think smells that make us feel at home or loved or happy are kind of the smells God emits. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say incense and stuff like that, but I kind of don't see it that way.
Me too. I went right away to like the very homey smells, like bread baking or Christmas smells or like garlic. Garlic always makes me hungry.
Garlic.
It does. I can't help it. Or, you know, even like smelling like the earth, like nature in a very quiet place, that kind of earthy smell. Yeah,
like loam.
Very familiar, very comforting kind of smells.
Yeah, that's what I went for, just the general theme, is comforting and loving and safe and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Well, what smells do you think are most pleasing to God in that case?
I'd go down a similar road. I mean, I think baking and garden work and... I can think of sounds along a similar vein with laughter. You know, I know we're not on sound. Sorry, stay on the olfactory.
No, it's
stay
okay.
On olfactory. I do think God loves the smell of incense because I think God sees what we're trying to do with incense when we burn incense, like in a liturgical context. But I also think, and I think we'll touch on this later, but I just think the smell of God's people in all of their lifetime activities, whether it be hard labor, where the smell might not be pleasant, or athletics, where someone's achieving and using the giftedness that they have. I mean, when we're using our gifts and there are smells involved, I think that's okay. I think God really appreciates that. God likes flatulence if it means we've eaten and enjoyed a good meal.
Oh, Alice. But you did get me thinking, you know, paint, the smell of paint when someone, an artist, is painting, or the smell of ink when we're writing, or the smell of old books, which to some people is not pleasant, but certainly to people like you and I, very, very pleasant. Yeah.
Well, you
yeah.
know, they say that the sense of smell is one of our, the deepest memory-evoking sense that we have of our five senses. And so I think that's part of why, if I were the author of this book, that's why I would have been exploring this, because I think smell can bring us back to very deep places in ourselves, and God is at the most deep place in ourselves.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, continuing with the idea of God as a sensory experience, the author writes, What does it mean to say that my sensory life is entangled with my life with God? What does it mean to say that my olfactory practices, the way I smell scents, and the things I think about the scents I smell, might also be spiritual practices? What does it mean to say that I am to smell Jesus in and on other people? What do you think about that, Alice?
This is a complicated one. it's easy for me to think about life being sensory life being entangled with God, because I can give so many personal examples of how I experience that. I mean, my morning walks alone are sensory experiences on so many levels. Family meals are sensory experiences, liturgy, sacrament. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, if you are a person who is paying attention and open to what's happening around you, I and see God in that, I think that's an easy connection. But to say that I am to smell Jesus in and on other people, the immediate example that comes to my mind that is a challenging one is thinking about being in places where there are bad human odors, as we would describe them, unclean clothing, squalor, things like that, where humans are living without basic needs being met. Those are hard places where we're called to smell Jesus on other people, but I think those are probably the most important places where we might meet that experience.
Yeah, yeah. Now, see, here for me is where the whole smell of natural smell, the way people smell naturally, kind of comes in. I'm really sensitive to smells, and I get migraines from like perfumes and chemicals and things. So to me, I think smelling Jesus in or on someone is more akin to the way the person's body naturally smells, not in a gross way, but the way you said, like when you slept in your mom's bed shortly after she mm-hmm. died, or the way, you know, I know my husband's scent, or dogs and cats know their owner's scent. I think smelling mm-hmm. God in another, on other people, involves something more than just sniffing with your nose. I think it's more like ferreting out the smell of their soul. And they say that we're attracted to the smell of certain people, that it's, you know, mm-hmm. some sort of chemistry among people. Maybe it's like that, but only on a more spiritual level.
Yeah, I think so. And last week we kind of touched a little bit on the concept of sheep recognizing their mm-hmm. owners, their shepherd
yep.
smell. And I think it's kind of that same way. It's an identification that is, yes, it's olfactory, but it probably has more connection than that. It's probably broader than that.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Interesting concepts, though. I really am interested in this.
Yeah. Oh, it's a wonderful book. Well, as you alluded, this is where God as scent becomes tricky, because we're trained from a very early age to like what is pleasing to smell and to discriminate against people who smell bad. What does this mean in a Christian life? Quote, perhaps if smelling is to be part of my relationship with God, I might start here, trying to unlearn whatever I have been taught between the relationship of smell to virtue, trying to notice how I let smell become a barrier between me and people who might be my friends. The possibility of my being a sweet-scented offering may turn precisely on my remembering that Jesus, the fragrance of life, was sometimes a homeless man. He surely sometimes stank. Well, Alice, how do we allow scent to divide us from other people, and how can we get past it?
Well, this was a little bit in your face to me, not in a negative way, but in a eye-opening. I had never really brought to the front of mind the concept that I discriminate and have been enculturated in some ways to discriminate against people who smell bad, and that's a learned behavior as opposed to just something innate. You know what I mean? I mean, so I'm going to have to really work a little bit on this, because I can see some areas of darkness in my own life related to this. And
oh, yeah.
And it goes beyond that. It goes to how people are clothed, just general appearance of people, you know, the judgment calls we make and I make. So I think using some scriptural work with that would help us see Jesus as identifying with and at times being homeless, and kind of helping us connect to that. Maybe watching Godspell, where Jesus looks absolutely maniacal sometimes with crazy hair and whatever. But I think that's a good way to pray about it and try and remember and see Jesus as that, and then therefore see Jesus in the people who we are judging or separating ourselves from because of smell or appearance or whatever.
Yeah.
It takes some definite focus and prayer, though. I don't think you can just wake up one morning and say, well, I'm going to change that, because it is a pretty deeply enculturated belief system.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm very much in tune with you when you say it's an area of darkness in your life. Absolutely it is. It's a huge mm-hmm. fault of mine. I just react so strongly to odors that I choose not to want to be around certain people, or think of them maybe as people I can't be close to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because there's partly just, yes, things that smell bad we think are bad. But also, when a smell causes pain, as migraines do, how do you get past that very primal thinking of pain equals bad? I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's from an early age, pain equals bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, so you... When it comes down to brass tacks, I don't know how to switch off my nose and not let it make those kinds of decisions for me, other than, as you say, constantly struggling with it and constantly being mindful of not falling into that trap.
Well, yeah, and I think, Lori, too, acknowledging that as a physical reality for you, and then saying to yourself, how can I be creative in finding other ways to serve the population of people that I am struggling to physically be around and be present to? I mean, because I think
yeah.
there are ways to do that, but the place where I'm struggling is that I feel like I need to be and am being called to be more present to people who are on the margins, and particularly in our city, just the whole situation with crime that we're having, and the underbody of why we have crime and all the systemic issues. And, you know, I don't know what it is God's calling me to do, but I feel a certain amount of fear about it, because I think it's more than just writing a check to some agency, which would feel very easy to me. And so, you know, you begin to enter into some of those things in your own prayer life and trying to say, I am a servant, Lord, where will you place me? You know, I will be
right.
open to where you lead me. I keep putting all these caveats, you know.
Oh,
so,
yeah, it's easy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think
but,
that's
which
very
is
natural.
A little, it's off the smell, the odor tangent, but, you know.
No, but it's
kind.
All related, though, you know. We prefer
yeah.
what we prefer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, moving on, let's go on to the idea of God as bread and wine, a metaphor that I would think any Christian would be very familiar with. The author says, quote, I once asked a circle of people from church, if Jesus is the bread of life, what kind of bread is he? Well, Alice, let's hear it.
Well, I have to say that, of course, I've chosen the bread that I love the best, which is like a really good, warm, crusty sourdough bread with a hard crust, but a really nice, soft, delicious, warm interior, because to me, that's it's an inviting, homey, welcoming, kind of loving, feel-good-about-things bread. What do you choose?
Okay. Now, out in California, and maybe other places I don't really know, but we have or had a bread that, with great political incorrectness, we called squaw bread. And it was basically...
Yeah, I know what that is.
Yeah, whole wheat bread with molasses in it.
Yeah.
It's slightly sweet, it's very filling and satisfying, and so if I have to choose, then I'm going to go with squaw bread, because partly it's a comfort food from my childhood that I still enjoy as an adult. It's hearty and healthful. And it's a kind of bread that makes you kind of feel good about yourself when you're eating it. So it's
mm-hmm.
you know, it's got all the feel good components along with the healthy and good for you components. You know?
Uh-huh.
It's
kinda like Raisin Bran, Lori.
Yeah, like Raisin Bran. But if you loved Raisin Bran, that sort of thing.
Yeah. If you loved Raisin Bran, that's right.
Yeah.
It's funny to think about that. I'm thinking about, are there other people, like what kind of bread would Mary be? What kind of bread would Thomas be?
And the funny thing is, neither of us went to unleavened bread of the sort that we get at Mass.
No, and in fact, I would have to say that, and I get the what that means and the symbolism of it and all that, but I would say some full-bodied bread would be a lot more inviting to people.
I agree. And I think if you asked a number of people, you know, what kind of bread is God, none of them would say that sort of bread.
No, because you don't even associate that little wafer, at least in the Catholic Church, with bread. I don't anyway. I mean, I know it. I know it symbolically, but...
Yeah, you don't think of it in the same nourishing way as you do, say, a sourdough.
No. No, and the other thing I was going to say about sourdough that I went out of my brain that you made me think of is the other thing I like about sourdough, like a crusty kind of long loaf of sourdough, is that when you eat it, you can just pull it apart and hand it. And I really do think that that would be part of the bread Jesus, the form of bread Jesus would show Jesus' self in if Jesus were bread.
I like that. I was going to say something like, because it's made from a starter that is often passed on to other people too.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of transmitting of idea.
Yeah, I like that. Well, that's kind of like that. Isn't it called friendship bread where you pass along the start?
Very much the same. Yeah.
Yeah. See, this is just growing. This is beautiful.
Well, one of the answers that the author receives when she asks the question is chocolate tea bread. And the author wonders, if God is chocolate tea bread, God is not only pantry provision, God is also about delight. Have you ever thought about God as bread in this way, both as food for survival and as pleasure? Does that change anything for you?
Well, I like it. I can't say that I have thought about it in this way, but it does make sense to me that there's sustenance and enjoyment. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of why I see some young people drawn to liturgies on college campuses, because there's both the sacramental life and then there's the communal life. There's the fun part of being with other young Christians. I mean, it's kind of that same concept. So it's kind of a good illustration. I don't even know what chocolate tea bread is, but I think you could use your squaw bread in the same, you know, with the same thing, that there's delight in it. It's neat to eat. You could say monkey bread the same way. It's fun to eat. It's
so
pleasurable. Well, nourishing yourself, I think, for most people is pleasurable in general. I just don't know many people who really do only eat to live. Most people I know live to eat, you know?
Yeah. But to me, it doesn't change the metaphor for me, because I've always thought of God as both necessary and delightful. I mean, in the same way that plants can be both utilitarian and just pretty for pretty's sake, you know? I think of the way that human beings love to give and receive gifts and our delight in things that make us laugh, which seem inconsequential. I think God bears us through our lives in a very practical way, but I think God loves to surprise us in unexpected ways.
Well, I do too, but you said you've always understood that. See, I haven't. Oh, I do now. And there are times when I laugh because of things that God does to delight me. But I can't say that that's a pretty recent awareness, I think, at least on a conscious level. But you've known that even since childhood?
Well, I wouldn't say super early childhood, but I'd say about, 8 or 9. I've had my first experiences of God as pure delight.
That's cool. I suspect... that may be a difference between how our mothers experience God, if we really got into that conversation someday. Yeah, interesting. Well, yeah. I'm glad we're both experiencing it, no matter how late one of us came to it in our life.
Exactly. Well, our next quotation expands on this idea. Maybe God feeds us not just because that is what a God does, provide. Maybe God gets something out of it. Maybe it makes God feel good to feed us. What do you think about that?
I think that is true. Because I do kind of choose to put the best parts of humanness as a quality of God. I'm okay with doing that as much as I can separate out and be okay with not putting any negative human traits on God. You know, I don't feel that's contradictory. I think God delights in nothing more than seeing us delight in something.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's why God created the things that God created, and that's why God gave us the gifts and talents that we have, so that we just are continually opening Christmas gifts, you know, if we allow ourselves to.
Yeah, and especially I love to feed people. I particularly like to bake for people, so I can readily identify with, you know, how God might feel the same way. When you love somebody, you like taking care of them, and you like seeing them enjoy something that you've made for them. And, you know, my mind goes back to our very first show, which was The Color Purple. Remember a quotation about seeing the color purple in the middle of a green field and how God puts that there for us to enjoy? I think that applies in this case as well.
I do, too. I mean, why would a great and magnificent creator create for any other reason than enjoying the gift and the ability and the, I mean, if when you are all-encompassing love, you really don't have any choice but to just do things purely out of love and delight in other people. I think that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you even just think about, God could have created everything for a very utilitarian purpose. But then why make peacocks? Why make irises? There's so many things that you think, that can only be here because it delighted God to make it.
Yeah, I agree. Sloths would be another one of the examples I would use. Those are the funniest darn animals.
I know, and they always look like they're smiling.
Well, they're slow as heck. Of course they're smiling. They have no stress.
Oh, dear. Okay. Well, once again, our discussion comes back to body image. The author writes, "Here's what I know about bread and wine. I know many women who don't eat bread, don't keep it in their homes, refuse the bread basket at restaurants. I can't imagine that this is what Jesus meant for us to think. Or maybe he imagined just that. Maybe one of the invitations he was making at the Last Supper was an invitation to anxious middle-class women 2 millennia in the future, the invitation to let his bread and his wine and his Eucharist reshape the way we hold and eat and sip and feel about all bread and wine." Well, what do you think about all this needless complication of thought around the idea of a food staple like bread? Is that part of the Eucharistic call? Should it, God as bread, be a simpler notion? Why is this metaphor so entangled in the idea of female, especially body image? And how can we loosen those bonds?
Well, this is deep. This is deep. And I have to admit, my brain is going to gluten-free thinking. And I'm going to have to be careful. I've never thought about the bread and wine in this way, so I'm in uncharted territory for myself, for sure. But I think if you would place food and food addictions in the same context, addictions or issues, if you will, because it doesn't have to be eating a lot of food, it can be not eating food. I think that once again we're back to whether or not the imagery and the use of bread and wine were specifically meant to be touching that issue that, you know, this millennium of anxious middle-aged women have. I think it is a way, it's a place where we can meet Christ and heal from whatever is difficult. For me, you know, I think it's stretching it a little, it's a little overcomplicating it to me to go to that being the major issue, but I don't know. I'm not answering that very well, but it's unconsidered previously for me. And to me, I guess I would place it, as I said, within the context of it's just another broken place in a person where Jesus could touch and change.
Yeah. Yeah, and I do want to mention, of course, there are people who legitimately cannot eat bread because of the gluten. As a person with dairy allergies, I totally understand that. And that's not what mm-hmm. this is about.
Right.
But I do know
right.
people or have seen people who refuse to eat bread simply because it's fattening or mm-hmm. it's perceived as fattening. I don't know. I think about the way Jesus ate in the Bible and the way his disciples ate. They ate when they were hungry, and they
mm-hmm.
ate the foods that were local and traditional to them, and they didn't
mm-hmm.
really place any kind of guilt or feelings on the food. Like, you think about the story of, it was the Sabbath, and the disciples were eating the wheat, and the
mm-hmm.
Pharisees got all upset. Yeah, they don't put any kinship between guilt and food. And I think that's really the way to look at it, or to strive
yeah.
to look at it.
Yep. Yeah, I think if you were to look at the images of food and nourishment and meals in the Bible, in the both the Scripture of the New and Old Testament, you would and use that as the balancing lever in your own life related to food.
Mm-hmm.
Eating when you're hungry, you know, eating only what your portion is, you know, all those things, thinking about others' needs of food would probably be a really good balance, super diet we could market and sell in this country if we wanted to. The Bible diet.
If we wanted to be millionaires.
Yeah. Well, now, here's another thought I had, too, kind of a little tangent here. But I remember being a little girl and living on Delaware Street, and behind us on Pennsylvania Street, there were these two, oh, and I hate this word, what's the word you call older women who never marry? Spinsters?
Spinsters. It's a terrible word.
It's a terrible word. There,
yeah.
For the grace of God, go us, Lori. We could have been
yeah,
spinsters.
Very much
then we
so.
Could be roommates. That would be a riot. Anyway, I digress. So these two so-called spinsters, and I think their last name was Ross, they went to church and mass every day. Went to the communion service or mass every day at St. Joan of Arc Church, and they never took communion. Catholic ladies, cradle Catholic. So I remember asking my mom about this once, and Mother said, they both feel they are in such a state of sin that they are not worthy of going to communion.
Wow.
And I can remember even as a little child, so maybe I did delight in God as a little child, but as a little child thinking, well, that's pretty stupid. These dumb ladies go to confession like once a week, which who does that? I don't do that. They go to confession once a week to get all the of all the people in the world that are worthy of going to communion, who are these two ladies? What have they done, you know? And so I think about them sometimes. I think, I go to communion because I know I'm not worthy. I mean, I don't withhold that from myself. Maybe I should, but so I think about that in contrast with the food, or in connection with the food thing, you know, where you're denying yourself. It's kind of the same thing.
It is, very much so. I feel so sorry for them.
Oh, it makes me so sad. I mean, what a horrible burden those women were carrying.
Yeah.
I wish some of the contemporary priests who talk about mercy, I wish they'd known Pope Francis.
Yes, yes. I feel for them. Well, friends,
yeah,
we
too.
Have still not existed the pleasures of this book. We'll return to it again, perhaps in a few weeks. But next week, we'll go on to something new and different, and we hope you'll join us. Until then, if you're looking for God, just open a book.
Thanks for listening.